It's hard to say what is the soundtrack or the sound theme of our generation, but one thing's for sure is our generation, at least, is putting it on MP3, putting it down optical fibres, storing it on iPods, phones, everything. We're all listening to it digitally. Previously, we had bands play it, or eventually the travelling minstrel used to play it. About our generation, it's all computer music. So I have a question for you. What was the first official computer music, and where was it played, and what was the tune? Well, the first officially played computer music, which has actually been saved on punch tape, was Colonel Bogey's March. And I'm going to whistle. I'm going to humiliate myself. And I've got some birds here to serenade me. And it continues like that. It sounds a bit more scratchy. And that was played on some surplus, specialty World War II radar equipment, which was converted by some clever engineers into the world's fourth computer and the longest serving computer. It served from 47 up to just 1960, around 1960. That's CYRAC. And that's the Australia's first computer, the world's fourth computer. And it had the fame of producing the world's first computer music. It was claimed by other countries, but clever and artful research by people doing PhDs uncovered this unlikely first. Well, it's not unlikely first, it was an unproclaimed first. It was just a known first, and then fortunately the paper date and the paper tape was dated and the notes were dated, and it was the world's first recording of computer music. Now, that's the official music. I can tell you a little bit more that the music prototypes before it was green sleeves. So before that, played in the lab or to other people, unofficial parties who came in, was green sleeves. And a little bit more information is that green sleeves was actually played down a telephone line. So it was the first telecommunication of computer music, a whole series of things. This is just punch tape. It went in to this converted piece of radar equipment, which they actually converted into a digital computer. Now, that's the story of Australian computer music, and this is going to be a very brief description of computer music, but some of the problems of people coming afterwards to try and pick through fact and fiction. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. I'm actually doing this podcast because it's actually quite a difficult podcast to go through. There's the actual information, which I'm sure people overseas are a little bit interested in, perhaps not. But I suppose the interest is how someone coming afterwards, someone who's really not committed to putting a story together, is actually just piecing together the pieces of information. I was trying to think, I forgot to remember some of the famous people. So the musician who was also Australia's first computer programmer and developer of the first English language, computer language. So this is a language where you'd say for the X equals, and it was written in English rather than in binary, and that's a program called Interprogram that was developed by this programmer, and that was my father. So I've got a lot of inside information for it, and of course I've sort of benefited a lot about understanding about gates and valves and basic computer tricks to invert matrices or do square roots or do sums and additions and count in binary. And I'm going to tell you very quickly the overall story, a linear story. We're going to start off with, in the 1850s, a Irish convict who's taken out to Tasmania, and he's got, these are official stories, his profession was a fiddler or a violinist, which is raises immediate questions, because it's very rare that you actually get someone of that level. That's really not a profession that would support you in Ireland at this stage. And then it goes on a little bit later, just before the turn of the century, you have Errol Flynn's piano teacher. So the person who taught Errol Flynn, the famous Australian Hollywood idol, was my actual grandmother on my father's side. Her brother, so my grand uncle, Arthur Shirley, was a film producer in Australia, went to Hollywood, had varying success, a lot of strange things. But the one thing he did do is he set up a camera studio, a photo studio for shots of the stars, and he is, it's again officially archived that he discovered Rudolph Valentino. There's a whole lot of other stories. You can imagine there's heaps and heaps of stories, and I've sort of been left afterwards to actually figure things out. My grandfather was an educationalist and came up with the idea in 1923, patented digital teaching blocks called Hill's Constructive Counters, and there's a story about that through the Great Depression, the rise and fall of these pre-Cuisenaire blocks, which came out in 1956, the next generation of blocks, but these are educational blocks in which he taught my father a combination of some digital maths in the 30s, and also the music came together. So you've got that across, and also at the same stage of building some basic electronics, that all came together. So my father got his BSc at Sydney University just after the war at 17, and was conscripted as a sort of scientist helping hand, as the four engineers, I think one was Maston Beard, Trevor Pearcey was the English boffin who put it all, the electronics, the radar genius who put it together, and my father was the computer programmer who was able to do the digital maths, the binary maths, very quickly and convert what was a machine into what we would recognise more as a computer. And one of his, so that's a basic story in going through, and of course at night as we just basically had telephone put in just only recently at his place at Strathfield. So we'd catch a tram or a train from Strathfield to Sydney University, work there. It's a strange thing that when I was working in the laser labs down there, I was actually working in the same lab, same corridor. Apparently you need a corridor for doing radar, your basic radar work. And so I actually met someone who saw me and said they thought they saw a ghost, because I looked a bit like my father many years later. So I was able to actually get a lot of information to piece this together. And so we have the intense story of the Greensleeves being played on paper tape down a phone to my grandmother, or my father's mother. That's right, who was a music teacher who could actually listen. My father could hear that one of the notes wasn't quite right. He had to find out what it was. My grandmother didn't believe it. She thought she was playing it on a comb, the buzzing sound coming out on a comb. It was only later that she understood it was computer music. At the same time, my mother met my father, but not, you know, this didn't spark off anything, and he invited a whole group of college girls down to listen to the computer music, and their general listening first computer music, it sounds dreadful, it will never go anywhere, and they all left laughing at it. But fortunately things kept on pushing on. I should finish this off really quickly. There was a team, it was actually costing a huge power bill to run this series of interlocked radar unit, and I must admit I've still got some basic skills which have been passed down to me. This is the twisted pair and the plaiting of wires, these are these, and how to strip wires and various things, and how to I suppose, solder and look after things from this. And I don't think it lasted beyond 1952 because there was internal fighting. It was developed at CSIRO. There's internal fighting. There was the new frontier of from the radar jocks to actually do radio astronomy, which led to Parkes and us as a moon station. And the politics wasn't right, and so they brought out some experts from Britain who came and said, look, digital is not the way to go, analog's the way to go. And so these engineers didn't have the political nous, and so CSIRO said, pull the pin on it. Unfortunately, Melbourne University bought the Sydney University computer, and Dad was involved in packing it on a truck. And so for about a week, Australia's computing capacity went to zero as it was tracked up and rebuilt in Melbourne. And of course, Trevor Pearcey went back to Britain, and only by asking my father, I think 1973, I can remember the call coming through from Britain. It's a long-distance call, and Dad organised for him to come back to Australia. And he then collected the old computer, and it's now in the Australian Museum. So we've got a whole lot of history, and you can see the tape there. I should say a really quick thing on the computer manuals, written in print and punch tape, is jokes. And I used to be able to read it. I can't read it anymore. The actual series of dots corresponding, I think, to hexadecimal letters. And it says on the side of the computer manual, to understand the computer language, it says in paper tape, this is waffle. So there are all these secret jokes put amongst it. I suppose another important point that I want to say, and this is the truth section of it, is that at a critical point, they had put the designs for the next generation of computer, which was, again, a valve computer, and he used to store it in a waste paper basket. And of course, what happened is, at a critical point where the pressure was on to decide to have it or go away, a cleaner came and removed the diagrams for the next generation of computers. And of course, it ultimately wouldn't have kept up. So my father, for about 10 years, was the computer jock that ran the CSIRAC computer at Melbourne University. Of course, the valves would work best at night, so he swapped over to a nighttime shift and would speak to people during the day and run the programs during the night, and would frequent the actual little shops in Lycon Street. He'd eat very late at night to go through. And then at Melbourne University, he again met my mother, who was studying criminology and social work, and that's me happening afterwards. So that's that prehistory of computer music. And I suppose what the difference is, that rather than hearing someone talk about it as a, you know, impersonally or trying to actually claim the glory, it's actually an authentic podcast that you're listening to. I want to get back to some of the stories. Now, it is all true about my grandmother being a music teacher in Hobart, and leaving, meeting my grandfather, and them developing these counting blocks and going to mainland Australia to market them before the Great Depression crushed them. That's all true. And again, although we thought it was a family story about my Arthur Shirley and the discovery of Rudolph Valentino, it was all the Hollywood stuff. Was also true. I was surprised to see a documentary on TV which recounted some of it, and only some of it. It didn't recount the run-ins with the US, I suppose, FBI investigating insurance fraud and all this type of stuff. There was a whole lot of other stories which didn't get through. So just going back, a lot of the stories you weren't sure at the time, but eventually you see them in museums or they've corroborated. And overall, in Australia, you do have some shaky stories coming along. I suppose a famous story was when there was heaps of US troops in Australia ready to fight Japan, the Australian, and they sort of bullied and took all over the best campsites by trees. Australia famously came up with the story of drop bears. These are the koalas can actually jump down and start to attack you, and they're from trees. So the US all cleared out of trees, got themselves in the middle of the paddocks, while the Australians got the trees. Of course, that is true, and I've you hear these stories and you think they're tall stories. I just recently read a story officially in a heritage centre up at Katoomba, up here in the mountains. It's about how wombats dig fake burrows and lure diggos into them and crush them against the roof of a burrow and leave them. That's been officially written down, but I'm sure that's a tall story, but you listen into it. One of the stories which you don't think is true is that wombats do cube-shaped poo and actually mount them on the top of rocks, and that is in fact true. That is actually true. If you walk around here, you'll see a rock and there'll be a little cube shape poo that the wombats do putting on top. So it's I'll keep an open mind for this wombat and the burrow story, but you rather think whether it's true or not. There's another and so I'm working back to my skepticism to work through, working back, and what I'm trying to do is get whether some of the violinist stories of this convict coming out are in fact true. I'll get onto them, but if I tell them apart and then tell you another story, I'm just going to leave it there. Getting back into that era of convicts, there's a story of basically this Port Arthur, which is on a neck of land. The neck of land comes down to a small area which is easy to hold off, so you can keep them in at Port Arthur, which is a prison colony in Britain, in Tasmania. It's an amazing thing to see. It's absolutely mind-blowingly amazing to see this prison thing, because in the middle of nowhere is this Yorkshire three-story mill, satanic mill in the middle of it, and then there's sort of some rather scary solitary confinement stuff, and then up in the hill is some well-to-do houses for the more well-to-do political prisoner convicts. And it's really interesting, because when you look at it, there's a whole different flavours of how the convicts were set. And after this one, I'll just do a little aside on what we've learnt about the United States and stuff like that. So there's this stretch of land, and which is the backdrop, so they have a military post there to stop the convicts escaping. So one group of convicts escape, and to get through, allegedly they kill a kangaroo and put themselves in a kangaroo skin and nearly escape, but the actual soldiers want to have kangaroo for dinner, so they shoot it. That is, although it's an official story, it's got into the official thing, that's very unlikely. It's very hard to believe that anyone would mistake someone walking with a kangaroo skin to an actual kangaroo. But that's gone into the legends. Another story is Alexander Pierce, the convict. He was in Sarah Island, which is on the west coast of Tasmania, so which is a stormy, isolated coast of Tasmania. And there's an island called Sarah Island, and it's at the mouth of a river, and the river has a lot of tannin staining the water out of the river, so the actual water is this unusual red colour. And so the convicts were put there and told the water is full of blood and there's sharks and all that various stuff. But they used to then go up the river to get wood under terrible conditions and build boats. And at this stage, you can even see that there is a difficulty of actually getting the English Terror to keep its levels up. Just the sheer logistics and isolations, it's quite difficult to do it. Sorry, but this convict Alexander Pierce makes an escape with six convicts and makes his way across uncharted territory to Hobart. If you look at Hobart, it's at the very bottom of Tasmania, and the story goes that as he went along, they were running out of food, and he eventually cannibalized his other six people. He survived. He then confessed everything to the soldiers, and of course, we're living in this thing of these hijink stories. It's hard to believe what's going on. Of course, they didn't believe it, and they sent him back there. He escaped a second time, but then didn't bother treaching through Tasmania. He just made sure he escaped with some fat people and then began to eat them. And people found him with half-eaten people, and they realised it was true. So it's very hard to work out what stories are true. So going back to why we've got convicts, the reason that we have convicts is that England was generating a lot of convicts. They hadn't yet invented prisons, and the American Revolution shut down the easy source of convicts, and so Britain had to discharge its convicts through a rather circuitous route. There's a whole lot of Australian history which is written out. There's a whole lot of American influence in Australian history, mostly due to whaling ships which used to come into Sydney and do other things. They've just all the residents. The reference to American whalers, which were out here, have been carefully removed from our textbooks. It's only when you read the lines, just as an incidental mention of it. Look, I could go into the influence there. And I probably would like to talk a little bit about the American Revolution at this point in time. Very interesting for us in Australia, because we read it and we say, hang on. What are these Hessians? How come there's German mercenaries running around the Americas and the French and the Seven Years' War? And so it's a very interesting thing for us, for an objective person, or not objective, a view outside to read through. So we've got the convicts. Now, you've got that classic view of the convicts under guard of British line infantry. You know, British line infantry actually can only really operate a certain distance from a barracks, and they can only operate at a certain number. You can't have an individual line infantryman walking around trying to inflict discipline in a diffuse area over 50 or so square kilometres, and there's convicts everywhere. So a lot of the story that we've got of convicts have actually is a lot more nuanced. Now, what is true is that the colonisation of Australia was very much a contractual thing. So the first fleet came out in 1788, and I think there was 11 ships, and 9 of them were contract ships. So they came, dumped, and then went off to on their next contract, hauling not convicts but goods in Southeast Asia and all that type of stuff. And they're you know, these are historic ships, but they were historic when they came up here, but when they afterwards they had a fairly mundane life as a ship, and they changed owners several times as you follow them through. It is interesting. It was run by the Royal Navy, the first one, was an official one, And so they looked after the convicts coming out. And when you say that, when you listen to this, the second fleet was to come out, and its main, it was much more arm's length, and it had the aim of arriving at the colony to resupply it, so it had enough to survive the second fleet. Second fleet came out. I think they had a ship, they lost a ship which had all the supplies, so this time it's a bit more different. They decided to put all the supplies in one ship, and that sank or was held back. And they wrote the contract out not too clearly, and they said the number of convicts delivered, but they didn't specify dead or alive, so they were more dead than alive coming out. Many died, and they were really sick. And so the colony of just over 1,000 people suddenly had to swap from welcoming people, had to actually pull up and actually try and support these people. I'm only saying this because there's a sort of an unusual music story which comes through here. Then subsequently there was inquiry. It's because people wrote back to Britain. There's often fierce letters going back, sort of blaming and complaining and Admiralty looking at it all. And so the next couple of ships, and this is pre-potato famine, 1836 to 1830s, 1840s, the great potato famine. Sort of, it's also an economic punitive thing from the British, because they had more than enough food in Ireland, and they were just exporting it, so there'd be wheat crops. And you poor Irish people, I think 3 million people, a million people died, 2 million people left, and you had convicts amok, the Irish convicts. I've got to say that the Irish convicts were considered with, I suppose, amazing contempt when they came out here. And the sort of economics, the economics started off convict-driven, but the convicts were not necessarily the best labour, so that they got... So Tasmania was calling out for convicts because it didn't have a big economy, couldn't sustain it, so they wanted the convicts, but the convicts wouldn't stay very long. They'd move out, out to the rest of Australia. Just a story then. But to maintain health on the ships, the new ships, surgeons, I think they also did it on the first fleet. They didn't do it so much on the second fleet. And that's dancing. They'd get the actual convicts up the top. I don't think they were in chains by the 1840s and 1850s. They weren't in chains anymore. They would be dancing and doing exercises basically on the ship, so they were in some sort of condition by the time they came along. So it was a close quarters, and things, conditions were looking up, and there wasn't so much discipline. And it's only recently that in the last say 10 years or so, people have been unearthing things of critiques. People come to Australia and say, look, you know, we've sent here to reform you, but you know, it's completely immoral, you know, what's going on. The morals have gone completely with this colony, and everyone's lazy, and look, they're all going up to pubs and dancing. They're all dancing and playing music all the time. And it's only recently that we've discovered that the convicts and that branch of European society coming here was very much alive with musical playing. And so I still haven't come across the legends, which I've got a doubt with. Another aspect of the history which has been quietened down is the amount of whaling that was going on. That was important for the Australian economy, that we've decided we don't like that, and that's been wiped out. And so the some of the story comes is that this violinist turned out to be for at least a period of time, a wanted person, a highwayman, so to speak, or basically a a criminal, as far as we know. The only reason that was in the family story that was so, the only reason that we think this is that the only evidence I've got behind it is that there's people are still in Tasmania still have bad words to say about this person. So he was a highwayman, but he probably went against the landed people in Tasmania. So that's the only evidence. The other thing that we were told, and I think this is in the high, I'm still sceptical of this, is that he used his violins in his life of crime. So the alleged stuff is that he would associated with the crime of holding people up or dodging troops, would play the violin to lead people off into the bush in the wrong direction, or play the violin and then move off on a track or something like that. Now, there's some more detailed stories. Unfortunately, the people who had the detailed stories have died or have got Alzheimer's disease, so we can't ask anymore. But it is interesting element of music which came over with the Irish convicts to Tasmania led on to musical theatrical stuff, which led to someone going to Hollywood, and Australia's most famous film director during the between the wars, that's Arthur Shirley, and the music teacher, the understanding of music, which also led to other convict families who were more skilled, that brought out skilled convicts, and so there was, I suppose, engineers and other Irish convicts out, which led to the research and education, which led to blocks, led to the digital stuff. So you've got that history stuff, and I'm of course sceptical at finding it out, but I think the whether the facts are true or the fact is true about the Irish convict who was a violinist, where he actually did play the violin to distract troops, I'm not sure with that. But the more important factor, I suppose, the two factors are that these elements are coming together, which lead inexorably to someone who, given the first computer, it seems now natural that he would understand computing, given his pre-training way ahead of everything, and this music stuff, and it would seem natural that he would produce computer music. Seems what else would he produce? And look, there's other support stories, and the capstone on that is that we would normally sit back, and I think Bell Labs and other big things used to claim to be the first of computer music. If you type in to Google Cyrac or first computer music, or Interprogram or Geoffrey Hill, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y Hill, Geoffrey Hill, you'll be able to validate it. So that's those themes coming up, and I suppose the that's one element. The other element is the person at my end who is been entrusted with certain, I've got lots of documents and books and stuff like that, who've got it there, and I'm not a forward or in your face type of person who talks about this type of stuff, but just working through being skeptical, using skepticism at one point, and then finding out later that the story may have elements of. There you go. Okay, that you might be able to hear that. That's Kookaburra territorial call over there. You might be skeptical, but that skepticism shapes your detailed inquiry to find out more facts, and you find out what are facts, and you get also an idea of people not being too concerned with the facts and telling you a coloured story. And there are these coloured stories lurking out there, but they're things to not initially dismiss, but actually ask and find out, and sometimes you're surprised if they're true. So this is Peter Hill Explains, Keep On Doing Science, and I've shared with you a personal story. It may not be well produced, but at least it's an authentic first-hand podcast. Thanks for listening.